So I'm Ari Pileggi, and I'm the chair of the Communication and Media Studies Department here at Dominican. I'm the former director of the Gender Studies Program, and I'm a founding member of the International Environmental Communication Association. Come on in and come on up. And I'd like to welcome you to the final event in our Democracy and Equity Gender and Film series. And the goal of this series was to engage those issues that impact gender and its intersections. We've looked at films that explore women's reproductive health problems, legal concerns related to rape, and how gender and race manifests in the US prison system. We've foregrounded women's voices and engaged in spirited discussions. Tonight's topic, which is climate change, isn't new. We've known for several decades that the Earth is warming. We've also known that climate change is not gender neutral. Project Drawdown, founded by Paul Hawken in 2014, gathered a qualified and diverse group of researchers from around the world to identify, research, and model the 100 most substantive existing solutions to address climate change. Researchers found that because of the inequities they endure, women and girls are disproportionately vulnerable to its impacts, from disease to disaster. Women and girls are therefore pivotal to addressing global warming successfully. Indeed, educating girls and family planning, ranked number 6 and 7 respectively, are two key solutions helping to build climate resilience through smaller, healthier families and innovative practices that foster stewardship of the natural world. However, in October 2018, how we think about climate change shifted dramatically. Leading climate scientists released the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, what we call the IPCC, report warning there is only a dozen years for global warming to be kept to a maximum of 1.5 degrees Celsius, beyond which even a half degree will significantly worsen the risks of drought, floods, extreme heat, and poverty for hundreds of millions of people. And we're in California, we've been experiencing some of that. Those in the Midwest are suffering also. And our panelists, who are strong women in their own right and committed climate activists in their respective disciplines, are eager to talk about climate change and what we can do about it individually and collectively. We've deliberately tried to open space for conversation tonight. We have several short videos and questions for panelists. And we're encouraging the audience to ask their questions and share the climate actions they're taking. We're especially pleased that students from our dance program will perform as part of our program. And so the way that it's going to work tonight is we'll start with two panelists. The dancers will come on for about 5 minutes, and then we have two more panelists. Okay, any questions? All right, well, let's let the games begin. We're going to start with panelists introducing themselves.
So good evening, everybody. I'm Jennifer Stock, and I currently work actually for two federal agencies. I am the Education and Outreach Coordinator for the Cordell Bank National Marine Sanctuary, which is a federal marine protected area offshore of Marin and Sonoma. And that is part of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, also known as NOAA. I often have to spell that out because a lot of people think NOAA, NOAA's bagels. We're a federal agency, science agency. But currently, I'm actually taking a six-month detour, and I am the acting chief of interpretation and resource education at Point Reyes National Seashore, which is a national park on the coast. And how many of you have been out to Point Reyes? Raise your hand. Yay! Well, if you're out at Point Reyes and you're looking at the ocean west, that is where the National Marine Sanctuary is. We're helping to help protect that ecosystem. So as the education coordinator and as the chief of interpretation, my career has really been dedicated to education and interpreting the natural world and natural ecosystems to everybody else that may not understand them. And it's been the driving force for me in my career, something that I just love, and I've found all these different ways to do it. And helping to tell the stories of where we are, our sense of place, a sense of place with ecosystems and the services that they provide for other animals and also for us as humans. So that's where I'm at right now in my career and have done a lot of environmental education leading up to this. So my office is out in Point Reyes, and you're all welcome to visit us out there sometime. So I'm excited to talk with you all tonight.
Did you mention that you're a Dominican grad?
Say again?
Did you mention the Dominican connection?
Oh, yeah. I am a graduate of Dominican. I did my master's of education here, actually midway in my career with NOAA. I had an undergraduate degree when I was hired and really got interested in education, and I came here to do my graduate studies. So I graduated in 2010 from that.
Hi, I'm Professor Vania Coelho. I teach environmental sciences and marine biology and other courses here at Dominican. I am also a coral reef ecologist, and as maybe some of you know, coral reefs are in a lot of trouble, but there is hope still. It's my passion to talk about the environment, to try to increase awareness of the general public about climate change and what can be done to change things. Also, I think as a scientist, we have the obligation to do the best we can to find solutions to help cope with the changes we're seeing. And this is what I have been doing for the past 15 years or so since I have been here at Dominican. And it's just my pleasure to be here with you today. It's an honor. So thank you for being here.
Hi, my name is Alex Portishofer, and I work for the County of Marin, just up the road at the Civic Center. We have a bright new blue roof, which is really exciting. Such a pretty building. And I started last September managing a countywide initiative called Drawdown Marin. So it's not an affiliate project of Project Drawdown, but we are aligned with the solutions-oriented, more holistic approach to solving climate change. So the purpose of Drawdown Marin is to engage and empower the community to design local solutions to climate change. So all of the cities and towns and the county have climate action plans, but we think those aren't quite enough. So we're trying to identify bigger, bolder projects that reduce greenhouse gas emissions on a path towards drawing down, meaning sequestering or capturing more carbon than we're emitting. So I look forward to talking with you more about that initiative later. In terms of background, I've spent my entire career working at the local government level on sustainability initiatives. So I started in the Central Valley, worked for a small farm community, and then came up here and have worked with various cities and counties in California and all over the US. So it's my passion. I believe that the biggest change can happen at the local level, and we really have the local government has a direct pathway to people, and we can help improve their lives. So, looking forward to more discussion. Thanks.
My name is Liz Cunningham, and I'm an author and an ocean advocate. And my mission is to be a voice for the life of the seas and also the people who are trying to save that life of the seas. So I tell a lot of stories about people who get amazing things done despite difficult odds. I spent a lot of time writing and speaking about climate change because it's the number one threat to the oceans, and also writing about sustainability. And I love to be in events where there's a lot of dialogue, so I really look forward to talking to you all and hearing your ideas.
Thank you. So I'm going to start, and I'm going to hope that this film works.
Lately, we've been hearing a lot about global warming, and words like carbon footprint.
I stop this. I'm going to turn to Jenny and with the first question. So this question is, what is the primary source of carbon dioxide levels rising, and how are the Earth systems affected?
So as you saw in the film, carbon dioxide is a natural part of our atmosphere, and it's moving around day to day from plants to animals and the earth. And as you saw as well, that we've been extracting carbon by extracting energy out of oil and gas. And that is the primary source of the excess carbon emissions that we have in our atmosphere on our planet. So just the film just kind of captures it so simply in the sense that humans decided that that was the best, cheapest source to get energy to fuel the lights that we need and our computers and our refrigerators and everything that we need energy for. And so with as many humans as we have on the planet, we need a lot of energy. And so the primary source of these rampant carbon dioxide emissions that we have around our planet are from extracting energy and burning it into the atmosphere. And what happens is this carbon dioxide, we're burning so much of it, it's making this blanket around the Earth. And as we add to it, the blanket gets thicker and thicker. And the sun is shining and the energy of the sun comes through, and this blanket really kind of traps this heat around our planet. And as we add carbon dioxide emissions, it's making this blanket thicker and making it warmer and warmer. And so with this heat-trapping blanket around our planet, that's why we have our planet is warming. And so for, what was the second part of that question?
The second part is, how are the Earth systems affected?
How are the Earth systems affected? So we added all this heat. What is the dominant habitat on our planet? I'm just going to ask the audience. Shout it out. It's not green. I heard a little bit. What? It's the ocean. Yeah, 3/4 of our Earth is ocean habitat, which is a very large habitat. And it absorbs a lot of that carbon dioxide. It absorbs the heat, which has helped regulate our planet and made it habitable for so long. But we're adding so much. It's only so much this ecosystem can take. So our ocean is warming. Our atmosphere is warming. It's changing the cycles of how the temperatures and moisture move around our planet. A great example, this winter, we had these atmospheric river events coming, and it's from all the moisture being evaporated in some parts of our planet warmer, and then they concentrate and nail right here and boom, deposit all this water. And in other parts of the planet, extreme drought. So it's really changing the cycles of how the Earth regulates our temperature by changing our currents and changing the way heat is moving around the planet, causing a lot of disruption to the things that we think of as normal. And I've finally come to a place where there really is not a normal anymore. I don't know what normal is anymore. I think we're all in this place of shifting and adapting and learning about being resilient to these changes. So in our local, the next question I think covers that.
The next question, what are the local impacts from our warming planet here in Marin County?
So great example is the more extreme weather events that we've been experiencing. We had a lot of extreme rain events, very intense precipitation, and we're still receiving the fallout of that. I just, on my way here today from Point Reyes, there was another mudslide along the road and trees down. A lot of landslides from all that water and flooding. Sea level rise is on the way, and we have seen evidence of that when we have these super high tides, these king tide events, where the gravitational pull of the Earth, Sun, and the Moon together make this extra high tide. It's kind of a peek into the future of more water and where is this water going to go, and in some cases, Highway 37 has to close, or some parts of 101 need to close because of all this water. So sea level rise we're experiencing. Summers, there's some hotter heat events. It's hotter longer. And in the ocean locally, we're also experiencing the chemical effects of the ocean absorbing carbon dioxide. It's actually changing the chemistry of the ocean and making it a bit more acidic, which is making it harder for some animals to live. So it's a lot of different effects. Those are the big ones that I can hit on, and maybe Vanya or Alex could talk a little bit more about some other local effects of climate change that we're experiencing in Marin.
Or the audience, if you have questions. It's always a good time to ask.
I just want to add, well, we'll talk more about it later on in this session, but certainly acidification in Marin, we have I think most of you like oysters. Some of you like oysters. It's a big business here. And the baby oysters are very sensitive to the acidity of the water. And they're having a lot of trouble, actually. They're having to get to the larger oysters to put in the ocean because they're not being able to grow. So it's affecting us right here, right now, right? So it's really scary.
Ready for the next.
Off on the horizon.
A short clip from National Geographic about the changes that we're seeing in the oceans. As Jenny was mentioning, of course, the temperature is getting warmer in the oceans as it is getting warmer everywhere on the planet. And also because of that warmer water, we're getting stronger hurricanes. I don't know if you guys have heard about it, but hurricanes are getting much stronger, much quicker. So before we had, the good news about hurricanes is that you could get out of the way, right? So you know a hurricane is coming, you have a week to get out of the way, you come back later, hopefully nothing's gonna happen, but or be little damage. But now the storms are getting extremely strong, and they're getting strong very rapidly. So if you're on vacation somewhere, a hurricane's coming, you better get out of the way quickly, because it's gonna increase from a category 1 to a category 5 in a day. You don't have time. Before, people say, oh, category 1, I'm not gonna move out of here because I have been through so many hurricanes, right? That's what the folks that live in those areas say. But nowadays, you can't do that anymore because it's just strengthening too quickly. And that is because of the warmer water. In addition to that, so in the damage, of course, that those hurricanes cause when they come by because they're so strong. In addition to that, the warmer water is causing organisms in the oceans to have to either move to other places that are cooler, or if they can't move, they often die. And this is one of the main reasons that we're losing coral reefs. I don't know how many of you have heard about the big 2016-2017 coral mortality event in the Great Barrier Reef. Anybody here have heard? And well, the Great Barrier Reef, it's such a large ecosystem that it can, one of the few ecosystems you can see from space in terms of in the oceans. And the coral bleaching, so it's thousands of kilometers, it's huge. And an enormous part of it died in 2016, 2017 because of one warming event, a very long one, that is, but still one or two warming events killed the entire, almost the entire ecosystem. It's gonna have a really hard time to recover. Now the babies, the coral babies that were coming back to so the river could recover, they're counting them and they're down by 80%. So it's, some of those more sensitive ecosystems, they are in so much trouble that we are actually having to intervene. We need to do something to help them. Now, sometimes people say, well, why bother? You know, why do we care about coral reefs, or why bother? There's so many other things that we could be thinking about. Well, coral reefs are just a indicator species. And it's not just coral reefs, it's everything else that's coming with it. So ultimately, what we need to do is tackle climate change. And not just, we have to do it locally, and you have to do it at a country scale, and of course, globally. And not only we have to contribute to decrease carbon emissions, and we're gonna be talking about this in a little bit, but also governments have to do the same. And at this point, we really need to be investing in technology that remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Removing, just decreasing the emissions is not enough anymore, because if we want to stop the increase in temperature to 1.5 degrees Celsius, there's just too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere already. We need to do something to start removing it. The good news is that finally the oil companies decided it's better to invest on that than to deny global climate change, because they're seeing the lawsuits coming. And that's what they're doing. They're actually starting to invest in carbon capture technologies, which are very promising. So I do believe there is hope for us. And in meanwhile, while we wait for things to change, we need to adapt and help ecosystems to cope with those changes until things can really be tackled at the global level.
Good. Any questions? That's coming.
We'll talk more about it, but the hope is, to be honest, I think the hope is that it's so big. Climate change is such, is not just in the oceans, it's everywhere. Pathogens, the spread of diseases. We have some colleagues here that work with plants, work with human disease. And the magnitude and the pervasiveness of the threat is such that humans are just too smart to let this continue. At some point, we're going to do something effective about this. The question is, how long will this take? My hope is that I'm already seeing signs that we are already addressing this. Just as an example, the amount of electric cars we have on the roads already, that is a sign that things are changing. Those carbon capture technologies that are available now, and they're investing more and more, they're very, very smart. It's really astonishing because they're capturing it and put it in stone. So you're not going to lose that carbon dioxide. There's no risk for it to actually come back into the atmosphere once it's captured. Although they can remove the stone if they want to sell pure carbon dioxide for greenhouses and so forth. There is a business plan behind that. And also, of course, companies are being held accountable. And more they're going to be held accountable. More and more lawsuits are coming up because we're losing everything here. And why is that? It's because of fossil fuels. Well, you have a part to pay on this. And because of that, there is an encouragement for a share of cost and also investing in new technologies. Governments are going to have to pay a very, very hefty price for what is happening in terms of damage from climate change. They already know insurance companies. Talk about a business that's very, very in tune what is going on with climate change because they are deciding if they're going to continue to insure things or not. It won't make sense. So the tide is changing. There will be a period of loss. There's nothing we can do about that, but we can help to mitigate the problem. We can help increase the resilience of some communities so that they can withstand that this period until something effective happens. So that's my hope.
So the dancers, are you ready? And if John, you have a question. We need a mic. No, we're recording actually.
To ask the dancers, how much of the choreography is your responsibility and how much does it come from your professors and teachers?
That's a really great question. A lot of it is generated by ourselves. What Olivia has done in this specific process is she will give us an idea, especially from the material that we've been sharing, on the Google Drive. And we will use that material, say, just one idea, like, what do you need? And then we would say, what do I need? What do I need? We would use that to create movement phrases of our own and with a group, and then she would incorporate that into the piece along with some of her own material.
Yeah, I would say it's just been kind of a mishmash, like an awesome collage of pretty much everybody's ideas. It's just been a great collaboration so far.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Cool. Thank you. So and we're going to go a little locally here. I have a short video that I want to...
means to look to the people and to the community for ideas about what we should be doing around climate change. So that's just one example. That was a planning process, part of a larger competition or designing project in the Bay Area called Resilient by Design. But it's an example of how we can really look to our residents and to our communities as the experts, right? And incorporate their direct lived experience into the projects that we design. Yes, in Marin City, yes, in West Marin, right here in San Rafael, and really all over the county. And that we can better connect ourselves regionally, right? So the projects that we design locally here from Marin County, they might be within our geographic boundaries, but they might also be projects that make the lives of our neighbors a little bit better. So Drawdown is intended to be that holistic planning and implementation effort that looks to the community and engages and empowers them to participate through working groups and through helping us identify ways to engage with the community. So Drawdown is being coordinated by the county. Really, we're just the glue. There's a lot of already amazing things happening, so it's about identifying those activities and figuring out what programs we can leverage and expand. And like I said, looking to the community for ideas about what they would be willing to implement that, yes, does reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but also helps in other areas. So helps improve air quality, helps improve access to food, helps improve congestion on our roads, which we're all very familiar with, unfortunately. So the county is helping to coordinate the effort. We are convening groups to create these big changes, systematic changes, right? Changing the way we interact with the world right now. So we have six different groups: renewable energy, buildings and infrastructure, transportation, carbon sequestration, local food and food waste, and climate resilient communities. And those six groups are made up of all kinds of different folks: technical experts, policy people, faith-based groups, students, artists, teachers, cities and towns in Marin County, and also people from outside the county, which may seem a little odd because it's Drawdown Marin, but we're really part of a region. And there's a lot we can learn from Contra Costa County, from the city of Petaluma, from San Francisco. So we have representatives from different organizations and jurisdictions outside of the county that are hoping, we're hoping, that they help us see the bigger picture and provide different perspectives and different life experiences as part of our process. So we're about a fourth of the way into a two-year process. We've kicked off three of the six different groups, and they've had solutions workshops. So they've presented their ideas, and we're kind of working through what they look like. We have a steering committee that's helping us oversee the initiative, and they're going to help evaluate and prioritize what projects we should really focus on in the near term, in the next couple of years. We also have a community partnership council. So they're helping us raise awareness about the initiative in general, and then also helping identify ways that we can really get that on the ground lived experience into the project ideas. So that group has kicked off as well.
So you sort of touched on this, but tell us what the biggest opportunity and the biggest challenge related to addressing climate change at the local level is.
I'll start with challenge and end on a high note. There are a couple challenges. I mean, community engagement is a challenge. So I think first and foremost, you have to decide what is your promise to the public. Are you informing them of what's happening? Are you actually empowering them to speak up? And are you, meaning the local government, are you accountable to that, right? Are you actually incorporating that feedback? So figuring out how best to do that. Are you going to existing community events? Are you hosting separate workshops? Maybe you're paying community members to come to your event, or you're providing a training that helps build capacity in the community so that they're better able to tell their stories, and that elected officials in the cities and towns or the county pay attention to the stories. So that's always a challenge, not just here, but everywhere as it relates to climate projects and various other projects that happen at a local level. Ongoing consistent funding is a challenge too. So climate projects at the local level tend to be grant funded, and grants are very competitive, and you're oftentimes competing with cities and towns and counties from all over the state, sometimes even at a national scale. And we can't make real progress if we're relying on one-time funding sources. So one of the solutions we're looking at that came out of our working group is to create a local climate finance bank that would issue loans and provide funding for projects at a local scale. Opportunity. Back to people. At a local level, we really have the opportunity to make people's lives better. And climate change, sustainability, whatever you want to call it, is one of the lenses in which we can improve the quality of life for people. But we can really illuminate. These are the things you can do right now. You don't need to feel hopeless. You can take action right now in your lives and do it for whatever reason feels good to you. Do it because you want to save the planet. Do it because it's good for your kids. Do it because you want to breathe clean air. But it's an amazing opportunity to make a real change.
So I want to call on some students who have been working on projects that address some of the problems with climate change. So I need Ashley, you need a mic.
Wait for a second. Is this on?
Okay.
Hi, I'm Ashley, and I'm working in my in Mario Pileggi's environmental communications class, and my group specifically is the Plantful Seven. There are seven of us, and the goal for us was to look at plant-based living and how to communicate that to the world. And essentially, among Dominican students, but our goal was to sort of have a well-rounded approach at looking at plant-based living, all the different aspects. So for example, I'm looking at how plant-based living affects the body. Someone's looking at politics. Animal-based agriculture, what that does to our animals as well as our planet, and so on and so forth. So we have an Instagram account, and if you go on Instagram right now, I will allow you to get out your phones and you can look at Instagram if you have it. We would like you to follow us. So it's Plantful Seven. Did I miss anything? And so we're trying to post every day for the rest of the semester just something about our specific day that we're doing, and we'd love for you to follow us as well. Other than that, thank you so much.
Okay, so I'm trying to get another group. We have the transportation group. James, you want to grab a mic? And then the plastics group ought to get ready here. And Jeevan, you don't want to step in there. Okay.
Green light's on.
It's working.
All right. So our group has to do with transportation. So we look at different new ideas or technologies that are being invented to help reduce carbon emissions when it comes to vehicles. We're also looking at the Dominican community and just trying to gauge how everyone gets to the campus. I carpool with a lot of my roommates because we all live in the same place. And we are looking at different ways that people can use public transportation around here much easier and trying to help instruct them on how you use public transportation and where some more cost-efficient ways to do it. One video I did was I ended up going into the city and took public transportation all the way there and just filmed myself taking the different like ferry and the bus and the train, and then just speaking on how I felt the prices were and the ease of use, I guess you could say. But everyone on our team is doing something similar for different counties around the Bay Area. So some people are showing how to get here from up north. A few other people are showing how to get here from the East Bay. So we're just trying to keep people informed on ways they'd be able to get here without using their personal vehicles.
Good. And stay tuned for those videos. You want to, Jeevan, do you want to talk or you want to go for it?
Cool. Yeah. Hello. Hopefully I don't, not too loud here. So my group is Plastics 911. So as compared to transportation and Plantful 7, our group was focusing more on looking at plastic use in our everyday life and how to kind of eliminate that and how to draw it back down to zero, how to achieve a no plastics kind of lifestyle. The thing is, for a lot of people, trying to eliminate plastic wholeheartedly is really, really intimidating. Looking at plastic, it is everywhere in our life constantly, and just trying to be like, I'm going to eliminate that completely, is tough. So one of our main goals was kind of be like, how can we make this easy? How can we make this digestible? How can we show people little steps and little ways to kind of move towards that goal and really highlight how harmful plastic is? So like some of the other groups, we have an Instagram going. We've talked about, looking at plastic straws. This is why they're really bad. This is why switching to a metal straw. Here's all of the ways that's going to help. And so on, so forth. One of the posts that I made, for example, was talking about shampoo. It's not really something that everyone really thinks about, because it's like, okay, you go, you buy your shampoo, all's well, but then it's usually in a plastic bottle. Where's that bottle going to go? So what I was talking about is, hey, I found out about this thing called shampoo bars, just like a soap bar. Really straightforward, saves a whole bunch of plastic. If even, say, 10 students started doing that, it's gonna start making an impact. Maybe not a huge one, but it's somewhere to start. So our whole goal was to kind of, how do we address this in a digestible manner, and how do we get students really like invested in getting rid of plastic?
Thank you.
I obviously just need to come here and sit with students for an hour, and all of my work would be done. The kind of humans, we call it human-centered design, which is going to the humans, actually doing the things and figuring out what are the barriers and opportunities. And you've already done that in transportation, and you're doing that with plastic use, so I have a lot to learn.
We've got good students here at Dominican. Yeah. Liz?
I think I'll stand up because then I can see you all better. So if you told me 10 years ago that I would be standing speaking to people about hope, because, you know, Myrie said, you know, maybe you could speak a little bit about hope at the end, I never would have believed that would be happening to me. And before I talk to you guys, could I just have a show of hands? I mean, who's genuinely optimistic about our future? Who's on the fence? Who worries we're toast? Who wakes up at 4 in the morning and thinks about it? So, you know, one of the first things I want to do, I think that one of the most absolutely patronizing things I could do would be to tell you you should be hopeful, because I go through this entire range of emotions several times every day. So I feel like the only thing that I can really offer to you is just tell you my path and tell you about the hope that I experience, that is this sort of brazen, chest in the wind, powerful hope, and hopefully maybe a little tiny piece of that will spread to you. The first thing that happened to me for my journey was I was writing about ocean country, I was writing about the ocean, and I was writing this book, and I spent a lot of time in this coral reef in the Turks and Caicos Islands. And this coral reef became so intimate to me that I would dream about the different little caverns and caves. And I saw that coral reef bleach in 1 week's time. And I remember swimming through it, and I remember thinking, this is just below the belt. This isn't fair. And then I read Jared Diamond's Collapse, which had this thesis that perhaps because of climate change and environmental degradation, our entire global civilization might collapse. And then I got bronchitis. And I remember waking up one night and I'd had all of this cough medication, and I washed my face off in the mirror and I just look at my face, and my face was just full of resignation. And after I got over the bronchitis, I just decided through this whole process of thinking about my life, I thought, okay, we're just gonna go out into the world and we're gonna look for where is the hope. So off I went, open eyes. There was only one problem. There was really a big problem with my question. The question was not where, who. And when I started to ask who, then I started to see all these different answers. And I found all of these different amazing people working on all these projects that you don't see in the headlines. And one of the ones that really changed me forever was meeting some small fishermen in Sulawesi that had formed collectives in which all these fishermen had agreed not to dynamite fish. Does anybody know here what dynamite fishing is? Okay, so these fishermen, they're either, you know, large commercial fishermen or small fishermen. They make these concoctions out of fertilizer and matches, and they, or they put together bundles of dynamite, and then they light them, and they throw them in a coral reef, and they explode, and they obliterate the reef. And then they go down, and they pick up all the dead fish. And you go down, Vanya has seen this, where you go down, you're in a coral reef, you get to an edge, and then it's been leveled like an airplane tarmac. I mean, huge for miles, just little pieces of bone. Everything gone, monocolor. So I met with these small collectives. And these guys were like so proud, and they explained to me, they're small fishermen, that they had all agreed not to dynamite fish and to only use sustainable methods. And these guys like stood with like such pride and dignity, and they're all like, are we solid? Are we together on this? And I remember I left the meeting, and I thought, God, guys, you know, what's the deal? I mean, you know, it's impressive, but, you know, it fell over dead to me. And then a couple days later, I did another interview, except this time this was a dynamite fisher that he would only speak to me anonymously. And he explained to me that a lot of the dynamite was black market dynamite, and it came from a big boss in Singapore. And the dynamite and all the fish ran through the same organized crime networks that ran narcotics. So when these fishermen made their choice, they not only took like a huge pay cut to do it, but they also had the courage and the dignity to stand up and walk away from organized crime. And when I was like packing up my bags to leave Sulawesi, I just felt like my life was upside down, because I'm like, these guys have done so much with so little. And it wasn't just the dignity of a small act, which to me is already priceless. They had multiplied it, because in the last 10 years, there had been a 70% reduction in dynamite fishing in this area, and there were more fish than 10 years before. This was in the Wakatobi Marine Preserve in Sulawesi. So they had made big change. And that one thing made me feel like, wow, what if I acted with the dignity and the courage that these guys did? So it really kind of humbled me. I came home and thinking, what can I do? Can I function at their level? But that still was not a lot, that was not enough to give me hope. And what really pushed me over the edge to make me think, you know what? You know, the door closes all day long. I feel better, I feel worse. I see another tweet, now I feel worse. But what keeps that door cracked open for hope for the future? And that was really starting to understand how social change works. And what happens is when we have social change, like the revolutions of 1989 or some big change happens, right? You know, anti-slavery movement. You think, how did that happen? This is so shocking. And what happened was people had been working person by person, bit by bit, meeting by meeting. And it's an exponential curve. At first, it doesn't look like it's doing anything, but suddenly it starts doubling and tripling and quadrupling. And if you take any major social movement, it comes from the margins. And it's never fully calculated that you will succeed. And most major social movements, yeah, they wanted to succeed, but in the end, if you ask and you look back at history, and you see, did they really just get up every morning and visualize success? So many times, it was just this stubborn, I'm just gonna do the right thing, and I'm gonna do what I need to do, and I am not gonna quit. And many of the major social movements had huge, huge setbacks to the point where people couldn't visualize success, but they just were gonna do the right thing and not quit. And one of the big ones that I recently watched this movie, Suffragettes, about the women's rights, the right to vote movement. And if we just look back and I think, how come I have a right to vote? It was because of women who were beaten, mocked, they were imprisoned, they were force-fed, they were tortured, and they stood. What did they do? They just stood in the face of the impossible, and they refused to quit. And the clock on climate change is ticking louder and louder and louder, And the same thing with environmental degradation. But we do not know definitively that we're doomed. And so you just do what you need to do, and you will see how it's going to work out. But when I start feeling heat and I look back, I just imagine to myself, I say, okay, 40 years from now, things are really starting to turn a corner and we met this challenge. I think, how did it happen? It's because people are going to look back and say it was because of the people who didn't quit.
Questions or comments? I have a colleague here, Wolfgang. Do you want to talk really briefly about some of the research that you're doing?
Okay, thank you. Okay, maybe I'm standing here next to a poster which I made, makes it easier. My name is Wolfgang Schweighofler. I'm a microbiologist and environmental researcher here at Dominican. And I work on invasive plant pathogens. So what's that? Plants can get a lot of diseases and they might die because of diseases. You know, there are germs, fungi, bacteria which can infect them, like humans get a lot of diseases. And a lot of the diseases, a lot of these germs can come from other environments, from other countries, continents, very often from more warmer areas, from the tropics, the subtropics. A few examples here. When you walk on Mount Tam, for example, you will see 10,000 of trees dying. And that's because of a disease which came over most probably from Vietnam like 20 years ago called sun oak death. And it's now killing a lot of our native tree. It's really kind of having a huge impact on our native biodiversity and making our beautiful landscape less beautiful. Has also then a huge impact on wildlife because it kind of has an impact on food source for squirrels, for birds, and so on. Other examples, for example, is a disease of lemon trees in Florida. Florida is the biggest lemon producer. When you go to the supermarket and you get lemons, most probably they are from Florida. And because of that disease, lemon production in Florida went down for 50%. And maybe, you know, prices will go up. You will not be happy about that, you know, if you have to pay more for the stuff. We have a new disease which came over also from some most probably Asian countries and is now maybe threatening avocado production. You know that California has a huge avocado production, Southern California, and the disease has the potential to kill most of these avocado trees. That would be, I think, big drama for many people. And what does it have to do with climate? A lot, as I told you, a lot of these diseases developed in warm areas, in warm countries, and they came to the US because of plant trade, tourism. There's a number of ways how these germs kind of spread around our global, world, you know, globalization. It's not only humans are global citizens, so to say, but more and more also microorganisms. And that comes with some problems sometimes. And so now that when we have a warmer environment, you know, climate change here in California, for example, it means that the environment changes, it becomes kind of better adapted for these microorganisms. So the microorganisms are happy, they can spread more easily, more quickly, they're happier and can therefore have a bigger impact on our environment or also crop production. And here, just very quickly, you know, in order for a disease to develop, we need the so-called disease triangle. We need a host plant, we need the pathogen, so that's the microorganism, and also the environment. And of course, climate, water, temperature, and so on is a big factor in environment. And it's not only something affecting these invasive pathogens, you know, these bad guys coming from different countries. I'm from a different country, so I can say that. Anyway, it's also with some of our kind of local pests and pathogens. They might also sometimes be happy when things change, and for example, when weather gets warmer. Each year in the Sierra Nevada mountains, several million pine trees die because of bark beetles. And why is that? Bark beetles have been around forever, and normally they don't cause a lot of problems. But now, with the drought which we had and with the higher temperatures, a lot of the pine trees, which are adapted to lower temperatures, to different environmental conditions, now they're stressed. They're kind of not so strong anymore. They cannot fight back against these insects, so they are more susceptible. So the bark beetles can take over the trees. And on the other hand, most insects like higher temperatures. And again, example of the bark beetles, in a normal year, at normal temperatures, maybe they have two or three generations a year. So egg, larva, adult, egg, larva, adult, two generations. But now with warmer temperatures, with shorter winters, they can produce maybe three or four generations per year. That means more bark beetles and these more stressed trees. And the effect is, again, as I told you, each year millions of dying trees. And I think there's just a few examples on stuff I'm working on, but which are happening here on a local or California, US kind of level, and actually happening worldwide. I could talk about it for hours and hours. And there's a little bit of hope. I mean, there's things we can do and things maybe we cannot do, just hope for it. But definitely, you know, we can do research, we can look at the way how this environmental systems change. We can try to avoid the spread of the disease. We can try to help the trees. We can plant new trees, think about it, the whole system and stuff. So again, as people here on the on the podium said before, things are pretty bad, and I think they will get worse, quite a bit worse for quite a while, but there's still a little bit of hope, and I think that's just not doing anything is just no option, so just keep on.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes.
I had a question. I was wondering, in Marin County, what is our greatest vulnerability with climate change? If you had an opinion, or our top three, how are we most vulnerable in this area to climate change?
I mean, I'll go because I have a mic. You can tell me if you think I'm right or wrong. Sea level rise. I mean, we're surrounded by water. So sea level rise combined with storm surge or storm-related flooding and king tides. It's a pretty big threat. And I think, too, our county is quite divided, right? We say over the hill, but folks living in West Marin are less connected, maybe. And so when we think about climate disasters or natural disasters happening, we want to make sure those more rural communities know where each other are and have access to services if there's a fire or if there's a significant flood. So the closer we are and the tighter knit communities we're in, the better chance we have of faring well in times like that.
I'll also add, I think the variability of precipitation is a real threat for agriculture and water. Having water for cleanliness and for hydration and for growing food, we are really living in this wonderful plethora of water right now at this moment, but just a couple of years ago we were in a severe, severe drought. And so those cycles that become more extreme, I think, are a real threat too for our communities and how we handle water. I also think there's a lot of opportunity in our state for how we manage water and improving that, and a lot of effort to catch more water and to reuse water more locally, I think, is an opportunity that we can rise to.
I would add to that, the problem is the extremes. You have the drought, and then you have a fire because of the drought. and then you have the mudslide because then the next year's a wet year and there's no trees holding the soil anymore on the hills. So it's the extreme weather and those extreme changes are going to become more frequent. It's in combination with sea level rise, it is not pretty. And it's just one aspect of it. We're talking about disease. Same thing with coral reefs. Corals have bacteria on them that usually are benign, but because of the warmer temperature, they grow faster and the host is weakened and the pathogen, and they become pathogenic. They can actually cause disease because now there's so much of it. And then human disease, how it spreads, the vectors are more likely to spread because many of those vectors are insects. And many of the microorganisms that are causing the disease also are strengthened. It is big. Climate change, that's what I'm saying, it is so pervasive and is so, the magnitude of it is such that there is no way that we're gonna not do something about it as a species. The question is how long it's going to take to do something effectively. So that's why we have to adapt and mitigate where we can, be more resilient, do whatever we can to be more resilient, help ecosystems to survive the changes. But it is if you look at all the aspects of it, it's really, that's why 195 countries agreed that we need to do something about it. That's what the climate change, the COP, in 2015, I think it was, and to get 195 countries to agree on anything, that tells you how serious this is. Of course, then we elected our president, but that's another story.
Well, I was also interested in what is the county's response? Like, is there, obviously there's the proactive, but I was just wondering with the emergency response or what type of county planning is there for these issues?
I'll just add one thing. I think that, I don't know a lot about the local coastal plan. Maybe you do, or Dominique does. The county has to have a coastal plan because it's on the coast. And I know that they're addressing resilience and adaptation through that. I don't know a ton about it. Maybe you do a little bit more, Alex. But that's one of the local planning efforts that are involved with helping create strategies for adaptation.
The county has several different plans that it's created to look at various climate impacts, both on the coast side and the bay side. So the bay side's called Baywave and the coast side's called SeaSmart. So the county's engineers, along with some consulting assistants, looked at modeling related to sea level rise combined with storm events to see what sea level rise would look like at different planning thresholds. So we have that data. We also developed adaptation strategies, meaning what do we do at those thresholds to prevent inundation? Do we build a seawall? Do we move properties? How do we help private property owners? What do we do about communities that are most vulnerable, like the canal, like Marin City, that maybe don't have the resources to act on their own? We also have are required to have, so that we can access funding in the event of a disaster, a local hazard mitigation plan, and that plan is updated every 5 years, and it looks at a variety of hazards and then develops strategies to mitigate the impact of those. And then, like Jenny mentioned, we do have a local coastal plan, and that plan we're also required to consider hazards in the coastal zone, so not for the entire county, but within a certain radius of land from the coast. So we do look at sea level rise. It's required. The state requires the county to look at sea level rise as part of that planning effort, too.
I just wanted to add something, too, that we were chatting about before, that it's a general threat, but there's both a sense of complacency and also a sense of impotence. And so, okay, we just had a nice winter, we got some rain, yeah, the weather was a bit extreme, and there's this sort of reprieve. I mean, I feel it too, like, oh God, you know, maybe everything's okay. And yet that period of time in between disasters is where so much can happen. So it's so important to get involved
And the other thing that, just to reiterate, which I think we all tell ourselves, because we all feel like I'm working, but it's not changing, or it's not changing fast enough, or it's getting worse, is to really refuse that kind of cynicism, that cynical indifference that says that one person can't make a difference, to really just decide to do something, to get more involved and find people, connect with people, and start working together. I think it's Kathleen Hall Goodwin, someone asked them, what should I do and what can I do? And her answer was, find somebody else. Start connecting on an issue that's important to you.
I want to add to that too about a part of hope that I have is just how connected we are now as a species with our telecommunications, our internet. I mean, we are so connected now, sharing ideas, sharing our wishes across the globe, which is super inspiring and challenging, but really has a lot of power for hope. But I just want to mention too, like with the county pieces, these are plans being implemented by people that are elected by us. We are really empowered in our country to be voting. And that's one of the biggest things that we can do every day, with not just our vote on election day, but our vote with our dollar and our money and how we spend our money and where does the money go from things that we're buying, and thinking about that, and thinking about the sources of energy that we're purchasing. That's another area where we make choices that help the solutions magnify. So I just want to mention that. And on top of the go find somebody, is talking about this with other people and encouraging you to talk with people outside of California. We're in a state that really feels strongly about climate change, and that's fantastic, and we've passed great laws with great projections of reducing our carbon emissions, and we're well educated, and you're educated about climate, and I really encourage you to talk to people outside of our state to speak up to elected officials demanding work in this area, at the local level, at the state level, at the national level. We have to use our voices, and we're so lucky that we have that power to do that in our country. So don't not speak, definitely speak, and find the different levels that we can speak to.
I have one more question, which is going back to Mari opening and talking about the impact of climate change being a gendered issue. And I was wondering, if how gender is incorporated in any of these responses or assessments, specifically either in Marin County or in California.
I don't know, right off the top of my head. I want to think about that.
I think one way we're thinking about it in Drawdown is that we're trying to diversify on multiple levels the people that are engaged in the planning and implementation effort. So yes, on the basis of color, on the basis of gender, on the basis of socioeconomic background. So when we're in a room, does it represent the region? Does it represent the community? And kind of thinking more strategically or more holistically about that. It's interesting because when you brought up the educating, the two drawdown solutions, family planning and educating young women and girls, if you combine those two, it's the number one solution to climate change. But sometimes it's hard for us here to think about what that really looks like, because we have a really robust education system. Of course, we can always be working towards stronger women's rights, but those solutions are maybe more applicable to developing nations, for example. But you know, every little bit counts, right? So going into a school and speaking with young girls about why climate change matters, or just asking them what's going on in their lives and kind of elevating their opinion. I mean, those are all ways that we can kind of continue to advance women's rights.
I just add too, you know, having done a lot of work with collectives overseas, and very often I would go into a little village and do an interview, and immediately the men would sit down with me and my translator, and then the women and children would kind of watch like an audience. And it's very, very striking. And I had somehow special status because I was a Western woman. But if you ever have the opportunity to donate, to travel overseas, to volunteer, or to volunteer here to help women in developing countries, I think it's a tremendous way to make a big difference. And it also just, it works against the injustice, which is that our world, our carbon imprints are so huge. And in the end, if we're going to solve this, the wealthier nations are going to have to pay to help these other nations develop. So by doing that, you're already becoming the solution that you're working towards. And I think also, you know, there's always just the huge, ugly skeleton in the closet that we know that this is all connected, that, you know, the way the earth has been treated and the way developing nations have been treated is the way women have been treated so much. And you dig down deep with these issues, they are very connected. So it makes perfect sense that when you start working towards solutions and you're working towards the root issue, then you're also going to be bringing together gender, earth, and a lack of violence means affirming women. So I think it's really important to keep that in mind. And I think that is one thing that gives me a lot of hope about the world right now, is that so many women are really pissed off and stepping forward. And I think that's a really positive development.
I would add to that, I think it's really our responsibility to make those connections. Women's reproductive health and education is a problem here in the United States. It's a problem here in Marin County and also in California. And we don't necessarily make those connections, especially in terms of climate. And it's really up to us to not look out there, but to really start looking at what's happening in our backyard and make those kinds of connections. And I think that given our political climate right now, it's really incumbent on us to make those strong links and to take action.
Yeah, I think male and female too is a really kind of black and white way to think about gender too. So we can think about transgender and non-binary. And also if we look to other people outside of the climate change space and see how they've organized and how they've made real change, you were talking about social change, we can learn from other really important social mm-hmm. causes. And that's, I think, a way for us to better connect ourselves with gender and climate change.
I just want to add one more thing. For the longest time, there's a lot of research saying how empowering women, particularly in places where you don't have a lot of education and so forth, promotes great change. But more recently, people are starting to understand that it's educating the whole population is a cultural shift that has to happen, because in some cases, when they empower women to earn their own money and other things that, you know, we know can help the family and so forth, then the males sometimes encourage violence towards the women because they're earning money now. So it can't just segregate in a way, if I can say that. You have really, it's educating the whole population. It's just not to bring up the entire population in a way that's sustainable. I just wanted to mention that because it's becoming more and more obvious that it can't be just women that's being educated.
I'll add, this is not really related to my work at NOAA, but I'm a mom of an 8-year-old boy, and just recently listened to this interview about how to raise boys to be helping women and helping have a more even society in leadership as they get older, and raising them to have the skills to be fair towards everybody. And it was empowering to me as a mom of a boy to think about my role mothering him to be somebody that's going to be good to all people and helping women along the way. So I think there's a role for boys too, young boys and youth, to be part of that, not just women.
Well, and I just want to say, I won't prolong this, but I appreciate not wanting to necessarily segregate a response, but we know statistically that women are disproportionately impacted by the effects of climate change. And so that's where I was coming from. And we know, we look at forced migration. We think of that out of our context, but we can look at the fires that have been in the North Bay and people who have not been able to relocate. And we know statistically that the largest population that is not able to return home are women and children. And if it is a woman of color or lower socioeconomic class, then the odds are even worse for her to relocate. So there's a great study, if you're interested, on Houston and what happened with the hurricanes there. But I was just wondering if Marin was addressing it, because we know statistically that it is impacting women. So it was a little bit of a setup of a question, but I was interested about our response.
Thank you. Anybody else? Very quickly, John, because then I have another piece that I want to do.
I just like to take a minute and bring this home to Dominican for a moment, mm-hmm. and address everybody, but particularly the students. We have a sustainability committee here at the university. We were the ones that took the initiative to get the food waste composting in Calarega that began last year. And we're trying right now to persuade the university to subscribe to Marin Clean Energy and reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, which we have not yet done. We'd like to see more solar panels on the buildings. We'd like to see more outdoor recycling stations. And so you guys are represented by ASDU. And if you just, you know, cultivate an environmental consciousness among your ASDU representatives, we really like to see ASDU kick in and urge the university to do some of these things. And so it's, you know, that's a way to really bring it all back home as to what we can really do here in our community to jumpstart these initiatives. So thank you.
Thanks, John. Before we close, I wanted to let you know that the Dominican Sisters have a gather at Grand, and on Tuesday, April the 23rd, from 7 to 8:30, Sister Toni Nash will be speaking. The topic is called Aligning with Earth's Values and Methods. The print's really small here, sorry. Any sisters want to speak to this? Any sisters who are here want to speak to this? You want to get a mic down there quickly?
Yeah, I'm one of the sisters. I've been on campus for a long time. I won't tell you how long. But the Dominican Sisters are committed and have been since 2003 to implementing the Earth Charter. And first we played around with the principles of the Earth Charter and a little reluctant about it. And then in 2006, we our Congregational Assembly affirmed it as a major principle of what we care about, the Earth and everybody and all creatures living on the Earth. And I have one thing I need to say. I think that climate change is the wrong word. It's a blah word. I mean, if you talk about the climate change, it sounds like, well, you know, the climate's changing. And I think that wonderful phrase about no planet B would be so much better to stimulate a response from people. But climate change does not do it for me, but no planet B does do it for me. So that's just, and the sisters are very much engaged in implementing our commitment to the Earth Charter with all its implications. In many ways that we do this, we have our own committees. We interact with the Marin Interfaith Climate Action Group. We have something called Dynamic Neighborhoods that we're beginning to get engaged with, also addressing the same issues that we're talking about here. And then the other thing that we do once a month is gather at Grand speakers who come to pick up on what's happening in the world of our consciousness that needs to be addressed and implemented here and now in our own opportunities in our this time, this place, and this now. So that Toni Nash is very engaged in that full time, and she'll be picking up on what we can do not just in our own neighborhoods, but also how we can get engaged in the world problems and action that's going on from everybody who's aware and awake and alive that there's no planet B. Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions about that? Gather at Grand. What was the date again? I have it in my calendar.
Tuesday, April the 23rd from 7 to 8:30 p.m. And my students, I think this would make an excellent extra credit activity right next door. We're going to wrap up. Thank you so much. I want to thank Stuart Horn and Penguin Radio, and also let's give him a round of applause. He was here and had to leave, and to his superb students who have been doing all the tech work for this. We'll have a podcast. So thank you, and I also want to thank my colleagues on the stage. This, for me, the best part about this has been being able to gather with these women and to explore the topics tonight. And thank you for coming.